carrying on. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, a special on climate change and its very real impact on our society and civilization. It was John F. Kennedy who said, "Too often we enjoy the comfort of opinion without the discomfort of thought." When I see what is happening around the world with weather patterns, with more than 120,000 exceptional weather events in the last 12 months, becoming the new norm, where we have a Hurricane Sandy that adversely affects over 5 million people living in the Northeast, and that's only a Category 1, and people immediately go back out and rebuild. When you see tornadoes that are a mile across, the widest that we've ever experienced, when we see dust storms and sandstorms in Phoenix, larger than anyone can ever remember, where we have massive drought in over half of all the counties and states in the United States, where the Middle East is running out of water in many countries, where we have global warming that was for the last 50 years simply denied. Even today, where it is politically necessary to acknowledge it, it is politically inexpedient to address it. Hence, we have conference after conference where absolutely nothing constructive is accomplished, where promises made, ideals are postulated, and yet at the end of the day, we do not demand a Marshall Plan from our major industries to convert over to truly renewable, non-polluting systems such as geothermal. There's 10,000 times more capacity for geothermal to meet our energy needs than it is for fossil fuel or gas, and yet we spend nothing on it. What is the likelihood that we will have some events occur in the near future, this year, next year, the year after, that there is no mathematical model for predicting? We've been led to believe by, more often than not, a complacent and complicit media that whatever may happen is far into the future. We'll all be dead before that event happens, before the seas rise a foot. What if they're wrong? What if we could have some cataclysmic events happening in the very near future? We're going to explore that. My guests for today's panel include Professor Tim Garrett. Professor Garrett is Associate Professor of Astrophysics Sciences at the University of Utah, where he specializes in cloud physics and remote sensing and atmospheric radiation. He is also the present co-founder of the Fallgatter Technologies. More recently, he's been applying physical principles of thermodynamics for deeper understanding of the relationship between global and national economies to anthropogenic carbon dioxide emissions and its impact upon civilization and society. He has a degree in physics from the University of Waterloo and a master's and doctorate in atmospheric sciences, University of Washington. And his website is inscc.utah.edu/TGARRETT. He is joined by Corey Morningstar. Corey is a Canadian investigative reporter, author, and environmental activist, warning against the impacts of anthropogenic global warming and climate change. Working closely with climate change activists, she works with Canadians for Action on Climate Change. She's a member of the International Climate Justice Now and was a former president of a chapter of the Council of Canadians. Corey earlier worked on the People's Agreement in Cochabamba, Urubamba, and she's been a leading journalist in exposing the climate threats due to the XL Keystone Pipeline and Canada's tar sands. She writes for Counterpunch, Political Context, and other sites. Her website is theartofannihilation.com. Our final panelist today is Dr. Paul Beckwith. He is a doctoral candidate in the Laboratory of Paleoclimatology and climatology at the University of Ottawa in Ontario, where he also teaches as a part-time professor. Paul's research specializes in abrupt effects from climate change, such as tornadoes and rise in more fierce tropical storms, greenhouse gas emissions, and the global implications of the melting of the Arctic ice caps, and social media for climate change advocacy. He is a member and blogger for the Sierra Club and a participant in the Arctic Methane Emergency Group and the Canadian Meteorological and Oceanographic Society. And his blog is at Sierra Club, where you can look under Paul Beckwith. Nice to have you all with us today.
Thanks Tim, very much.
Tim, we're going to start with you. I would like to begin with an observation. When I search on the internet for information on the short and long-term impacts that climate change will have on geography and the environment, and as a consequence, the threats to our civilization and society at the day-to-day human level, there's remarkably little in the popular literature. Rather, I find the vast majority of it in the scientific literature. Now, I speculate that this might be for several reasons. First, the real threats of climate change and global warming have yet to sink into the popular consciousness and mainstream media in particular. And second, the problems are perhaps too complex to formulate clear predictions with a degree of certainty, and therefore there's little being written about them. And the majority of climate change's dangers are framed and presented as scientific calculations, and the predictions are therefore rather abstract and distant and impersonal. To say that a rise in global Earth temperature by 2 degrees will endanger life on Earth is an abstract statement for most people. However, if we simply say there is a great likelihood that two back-to-back Hurricane Sandys will have a strong possibility of wiping out many coastal towns along the New Jersey shore, that brings the problem home and awakens people more to the seriousness of climate change. So please begin by giving us your thoughts for why the impacts of climate change are largely being ignored, and why do people not discuss this more in the mainstream media or even in popular discourse?
Yeah, well, I suspect that you're right, that it is hard to bring home in the form of specifics something that is distant and is usually framed in terms of more of a global effect. When you think about what climate scientists are trying to do, they aren't trying to specifically predict, say, local weather 50 or 100 years from now, or even, you know, a decade from now, because that's simply something that they cannot do. Predicting local weather is something that's, of course, very personal and very easy to relate to. We plan our morning commutes on the basis of what a forecast might be. But if you talk about, let's say, a global temperature rise applied on a global level or a global sea level rise, at a global level, this is a problem that's, you know, difficult for scientists to address in any case. There are uncertainties, and it's a challenging problem. So that's what, of course, they might be focusing on. But it is, as you say, difficult to bring down to a personal level. And I think this is just a common challenge with setting up the problem. However, I think, you know, from the standpoint of what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to show how there are these fixed links between things like economic activity and global warming, how we have a coupled system here where it is our economic activities that, through the combustion of fossil fuels primarily, are leading to the emissions of carbon dioxide that accumulate in the atmosphere and are, in fact, driving global warming. But this is a two-way street because this, of course, sets up a situation where global warming then acts against us and ultimately acts as a drag on the very economic forces that have been set up by our economic activities, by our burning fossil fuels. So we burn fossil fuels, that raises carbon dioxide concentrations, then the carbon dioxide concentrations create global warming, which then causes negative effects on society. And in my examination of this problem, the way that this shows up in society is in the form of such things as increased inflation and probably increased unemployment as well. And so that might be a form where things do get increasingly personal because, of course, inflation and unemployment have a direct impact on our ability to survive at a, you know, even a family level.
Thank you. I appreciate those opening insights. Corey, to you, please. Do you have anything you'd like to add to what our guest just said, since as a reporter on the ground, you're regularly dealing with communities and individuals affected by climate change?
For sure. Thanks for having me, Gary. I just wanted to add to that, for example, the paper that just came out that actually I was just reading it, and I remember when it came out, and the system, we're all trapped in the suicidal system, the capitalist system, and that's what we really have to look at. And until we're ready to talk about that and look at that, you know, look at our reality and discuss this and figure out a transition away from this, this system that's actually destroying us, destroying our children, until we're willing to look at that, we're not going to get anywhere. And the truth of the matter is it's not enough to, you know, to change the light bulbs and to get these hybrid cars and everything. It's all insane. We have to get not only, we don't have to just lower emissions. The only way to cool the planet is to stop all emissions. And this is what you don't hear. This is what no one tells you, even though it's in the IPCC report. And the thing is, we can't talk about it because the system's set up in such a way, when you do talk about it, or when you publish a paper on it, or try to publish a paper on it, you're isolated. Your funding dries up. I mean, scientists, NGOs, the whole environmental movement, everybody, we're trapped in a system. Schools, universities, they're all dependent on this foundation funding. And we're talking about billions and billions of dollars that people are dependent on to live in this system. And so that's a huge, huge piece of the puzzle that we need to talk about. We need to figure out how to get out of this. But, I mean, we, you know, our culture loves us to believe in fantasy. And our culture loves us to be distracted, you know, and to listen to the corporate media owned by a handful of people and to distract ourselves with television. So the whole dominant culture isn't helping. I mean, it's destroying us. So that's what I would add on to that.
A follow-up for you, Corey. 2 years ago, I was the keynote speaker at Earth Day at the UN. And in the room were all these environmental group heads. The room was packed. I don't know how many people were there, but there were hundreds and hundreds. And instead of doing the talk they thought I'd be doing, instead I excoriated them with very specific examples. Non-emotional, I just asked, how could you accept $26 million from the gas hydrofracking interest and then have nothing in your program as an environmental group that is against this? And how could this other group, and I was mentioning groups of how much money they received, and all told, there was over $100 million that recently had come into the bank accounts of these green foundations. And how, I said, can you possibly believe that it is a healthy relationship to align yourself in a so-called green, a green cooperative with these private corporations? And unless you're completely compromising on what's causing our real problems. And I've seen a lot of people who are very popular within the environmental movement, but they're corporate, mainly corporate Democrats or corporate liberals.
Yeah.
And so my whole talk was, say, in effect, how could you have betrayed the entire environmental movement and nothing good has come and you're not taking on the hard issues?
Yeah.
Do you see that from your perspective?
Absolutely, and it's in it, like everything else within this commodity culture, has become normalized. You know, if it just keeps happening and happening, and people read about it, and people are sort of getting used to it, and it's almost like everything else. Well, that's just the way it is, you know. And we have serious issues. And the problem is, people think, okay, I can come home and do nothing, relax at night because someone else is taking care of the problem, and I'll send them my $20 at the end of the month. But they're all in bed together. You know, and so there's always great people within these institutions, and I'm not saying at all that it's everybody within these things, but there's always the same people at the top, and they know what they're allowed to do, and they know what they're not allowed to do. And one thing they're not allowed to do is to go up against the system where very, very few people, retain all the power, and very, very few people, you know. It's a huge power structure. So as long as you're not going up against that system, as long as you're willing to have people distracted and lead them in a different direction, you have to protect the system. And that's what everyone's doing. And it's to our own demise. So it's insane.
Thank you, Corey. To Paul, one of the areas you specialize is in the relationship between climate change and extreme weather conditions, which we'll get back to a little later. However, already in the New York Post last week, there was an article suggesting that global warming was not a fact because 2013 didn't witness any extreme hurricanes as it did in the prior years. And now we're witnessing wild early ice snowstorms from Texas to the Northeast. And hence we discover that one year there can be a record-setting extreme amount of storms, and then other conditions such as tornadoes and droughts, and the following year relatively mild natural climate-related catastrophes. So I'd like you to first begin by explaining why extreme weather, year to year, can vary erratic. And this is the sign of global warming, we believe, and others say no. And then speak a little more in depth about the rapid melting of the Arctic ice caps, which we've written about, that are now in a death spiral, and how that can contribute to extreme weather conditions, and what are some of the more certain examples we have seen due to it, and how much more serious is it likely to become as these caps further disappear?
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Gary. Basically, we have reached a climate age of consequences. The consequences being the extreme weather events that you're mentioning. Mostly we're seeing things like torrential rains, like a month, 6 months or a year of rainfall in the space of a few days or one evening. We're also seeing very large swings in temperature. It might go from very, very low temperatures far below zero to very, very warm temperatures in one location within a day sort of thing. So, what's causing this sort of thing? Well, basically, the warming is not uniform across the planet. We know that the land is warming faster than the oceans because of the oceans have a large thermal mass. They can store lots of heat, and it takes them longer to warm up or cool down, so they kind of moderate temperatures. But the main variation across the planet is with latitude. The warming across latitudes is completely non-uniform. So what we're getting in the Arctic is the warming from the elevated greenhouse gases, mostly CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, are warming the overall system. So we're getting very large melting of the snow cover, the terrestrial snow cover in the Arctic. And also the sea ice is declining rapidly. So the snow cover, when it melts, you have white snow, which reflects 80-90% of the incoming sunlight, and it's replaced by dark permafrost underneath, or soil, which only reflects about 10% or 20% of the incoming light. So you get all that extra light being absorbed. Same thing with the sea ice. When the sea ice is there, it reflects large amounts of light, keeping the Arctic cool. When the sea ice is replaced, melts, is replaced by dark ocean water, that's absorbing 90% of the incoming light warming the oceans. So as a result, those are the main factors that are leading to great Arctic warming amplification. So the Arctic is warming roughly three to four times the global average rate of warming. If you go to the high Arctic, it's even higher, more like eight times or so. So what this is doing is the equator is not changing too much in temperature, but the Arctic, the North Pole, is warming at very, very high rates. So what it does is it reduces the temperature difference between the equator and the pole. Instead of being a very large temperature difference, because the Arctic is warming like crazy, the temperature difference is greatly reduced. Now, it's the temperature difference that determines how much heat moves from the equator to the poles. If the temperature difference is large, you get a lot of heat moving up there. If the temperature difference is small, you get less heat moving up there. So what's happening is there's less and less heat. There's less and less heat moving up there from the equator because it's heating by itself from the increased absorption. And what this is doing, this is changing the circulation patterns of the atmosphere. It's changing the jet stream speed. They're slowing down in the west to east direction. The physics dictates that they get wavier. Instead of being mostly west to east, they become very wavy in the north-south direction. And because they're moving slower, they tend to get stuck in certain locations depending on the land and ocean contrast. The other thing is because we have an overall warming, we have more evaporation. So there's about 4% more water vapor in the atmosphere now than there was 30 years ago. So basically the storms that track across the continent are following the jet streams, and because the jet streams are slower and wavier, the storms go slower. So they deposit more and more of their precipitation in some regions, and they don't make it to other regions. Now, the reason why you have these massive temperature swings is because if you're in the crest of a wave going far north, you're getting the air from below, which is marine and warm. So it'll be very warm far north. If you're in the crest, if you're in the trough of a wave, planetary wave, then you get Arctic air coming down. So this is precisely what we're seeing right now. This is why it's so cold, because there's this jet stream is stuck. It's extending very far down into the western U.S. It's getting cold Arctic air coming in. Records galore are being set. Meanwhile, other areas in the other areas much, much further north are very, very warm and humid. So basically the nature of the circulation patterns of the atmosphere have changed, and it's a direct result of the declining sea ice in the Arctic and the declining snow cover in the Arctic. And as the U.S. Navy has a model, Maslowski et al. Is projecting that based on their model, which is the highest resolution, it takes into account the most effects, they're saying that the sea ice could be gone at the end of the melt season in September in as early as 2016. So as the sea ice declines further and further and the snow cover declines, they're both dropping exponentially, then the craziness or the structure, the nature of the whole jet streams will change even more. So I think that these extreme weather events that we're getting now globally are going to amplify up a factor of at least 10, within, as the sea ice declines to zero at the end of the summer.
Paul, thank you for those insights and details. A follow-up.
Yes, the albedo is just the reflectivity of a surface. So if you have light coming down on water, then it will reflect about 10% of the light, and the rest 90% will go into the water. If you have a bathroom mirror, it will reflect about 95% of the light. You see yourself in the mirror, it'll only absorb about 5%. So the albedo is just the reflectivity of the material.
Two issues I'd like for you to address in a follow-up, please. I received a phone call from a friend that lives in Wyoming, and he in turn has a friend that lives in Montana. And he said, did you hear, this is just a week ago, he said, did you hear about all those cattle and horses dying? I said, no. He said, I'll send you the information on it. The weather was so cold, so fast, that they had no time to bring in any of their cattle. 20,000 cows died almost immediately because they were hit with a tremendous amount of cold weather and had no place to go, no shelter. And on one farm, one ranch, hundreds of horses died. And the rancher said that he had never experienced anything in his entire life. He even asked his father, who had experienced nothing like this. So the fact that something could be that abrupt and that devastating. Then this past week, in the afternoon, the temperature was 84. That evening, it went down into the 20s, northeast of Dallas, when they got hit. You don't see 60-degree temperature change in a matter of hours. We haven't had that historically. So I'd like for you to address this second part of this, and that is, we know from the 12 tipping points that one of these is the conveyor, for want of a simpler explanation, that carries warm water north and brings cool water south. And that conveyor belt in the ocean, in the Atlantic, if the temperatures get to such a degree that it could adversely affect that, what is the possible outcome, and what is the probability that that could happen? My second question is this. I'm of the belief, since I'm doing a documentary at this point and have for 7 years on the 12 tipping points, that we have no accurate mathematical model for predicting any of the rise in the ocean. We have been given assurances that it won't be much over the next 100 years. And yet, when scientists are faced with how much of the Antarctica is melting and glaciers in the Himalayas, in the Canadian outback, and in Greenland. And you ask, is there a point to where it melts so much or so fast that it could cause large amounts of breakage where you not just calving, but you have huge amounts of ice going into the water, which could raise this or change the whole dynamic of ocean rising? Could you address those two issues, please?
Yes. The first reason to emphasize why you get such a big temperature difference is the jet stream kind of acts as a wall between cold and warm air. It used to be very west to east, so the cold air would be north, the warm air would be south. In the summer, the jet stream would move further north, so areas that were colder before would then become warmer. What the jet stream is doing now, instead of running west to east, it's running in waves very far north, very far south. And it depends if you're above or below the wave. If you're below the wave, you're cold. If you're above it, if you're above the wave, you're cold. If you're below the wave, you're warm. And if the wave moves slightly from east to west, you can go from very, very warm temperatures one day to very, very cold temperatures the next day. And then if the wave moves back, it can swing back. So this is what happened with the cattle. Now, the ocean circulation patterns depend also, I mean, the Earth is a big heat pump. The equator is warmer because the sun intensity is stronger and the days are longer. And so there's more solar intensity year-round on the equator. So the equator is always warmer. The poles are colder. The intensity of the light is lower, and the duration becomes lower, especially in the winter in the given hemisphere. So that heat has to move from the equator to the poles, and it does it in the atmospheric wind patterns, and it does it in the ocean current. So the ocean currents that get set up, basically, the Gulf Stream is the one that people are most familiar with. It's carrying an enormous amount of heat northward, up the east coast of the U.S. and then out across the Atlantic, and it It's responsible for giving high latitude locations on the west coast of Europe warm temperatures. So the jet stream, as the Arctic warms by itself from solar absorption, it decreases the necessity of heat going from the equator to the pole. So the ocean currents are actually expected to slow down. Now, according to the IPCC, the latest report, the probability of them actually shutting off, causing massive changes in the distribution of heat around the planet, is low. I think the one in 2007 had a probability of less than 10%, and I believe that the latest one, it doesn't really update that number. A report by the National Research Council just came out a few days ago, and it's on abrupt climate change and impacts. And it's also saying the probability is fairly low of that happening. But it said that the probability of Antarctica losing significant amount of ice to cause a 3 or 4 meter sea level rise just from Antarctica alone in the next, by 2100 is higher than they thought. We're measuring ice with satellites that have a very accurate measurement of gravity, and both Greenland and Antarctica are losing large amounts of ice, and that is increasing. The melt rates from those two places is doubling every 5, 6, 7 years, something like that. And the reason why, a lot of people talk about Antarctica, the sea ice growing around Antarctica, and that's just on the surface. I'm talking the satellite measures the mass on the continent itself, and the ice is being melted from below, and most of the western part of Antarctica sits on bedrock, which is below sea level. So the water's warming, it's melting the ice from below. But I think the most significant factor which is overlooked is the methane, because as the Arctic is warming, there's vast amounts of methane that is in the terrestrial permafrost, and also in the permafrost on the seafloor, and also in methane hydrates. And there's vast continental shelves off Siberia, the eastern Siberian Arctic shelf, and the Russians are measuring ever-increasing amounts of methane coming up from there, and that has the potential to completely change the climate if it starts coming up in episodic pulses, as it has done at various times in the paleo records.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Paul. Back to you, Tim. As a physicist, you're an expert in energy exchange, the relationship between how much energy is placed into a system and the amount that is received in return. Recently, you've been working on the relationship between our current economic system and the human contribution to global warming. For example, the amount of energy used by our consumer culture and its contribution to the changes in climate and still rising levels of greenhouse gases, which we're witnessing. As long as the economic engine of finite growth and progress is running, we will inevitably find greenhouse gases increasing. However, if the entire economic machine were to collapse, then the drop-off of carbon emissions would drop dramatically. In principle, what is being said is that while an economic recovery is good for the gross domestic product and the wealth of the nations and individuals' lives, it's terrible for mitigating or lessening the speeding up of global warming. In other words, it is our free market civilization that is the real heat engine, as you call it. The only option to put a very real halt to greenhouse emissions would be a systemic global economic collapse. Can you go into this in greater detail and speak more directly on the effects climate change has on national economies in general?
Yeah, sure. So, as you mentioned, I'm a physicist, and I think some people might find a physical perspective on something that feels as personal as civilization and our society might be a bit abhorrent, and I've been criticized for this. I think civilization is undeniably part of the physical universe. We may feel somewhat distinct and separate from it, but there are physical laws, and these are presumably universal, in which case they must necessarily apply to us. And so this was a train of thought that I followed, and I wanted to see if there was perhaps a fixed relationship between a fiscal expressions of civilization, you know, something that we would quantify in terms of, let's say, dollars, or where we use words like wealth and GDP, and see if these quantities had some sort of link to physical quantities, which would be things like rates of energy consumption, which is a very physical quantity. It's linked to what we often call the second law of thermodynamics, where in order for anything to happen in the universe, energy must be dissipated. Now, of course, energy might be dissipated because we simply drop something, or it goes from high potential or low potential. But for a civilization, the way we dissipate energy is by burning, for the most part, in today's world, fossil fuels. And the idea is that all the circulations within our economy, and our circulations span absolutely everything. There are things with us driving cars, say, to go to work and back, or we send off an internet search to Google and it returns with an answer, or we think, there's a form of circulation, we eat, we form social relationships, we talk to people, they talk back to us. All these things require some form of energy dissipation, and without energy dissipation, all these things would necessarily grind to a halt, and civilization would fail to exist. And what I found was that there was actually a fixed relationship between a fiscal expression of civilization and our rate of energy dissipation. A lot of people have looked at this in the form of the relationship between GDP and energy consumption, you know, the gross world product, how much wealth we add every year through production. And that's not what I showed was a fixed relationship. Rather, it was more our accumulation of production over the entire course of history. So things that we've produced in the past, they do decay, but we also carry a good chunk of them forward to the present. And that includes things like our buildings and roads that we use to convey things today, but also things like our common culture. And all of this must be sustained. If we turned off the tap, their supply of energy, then we would no longer be able to eat, we would no longer be able to talk, and our culture would die, our cars would stop, everything in the world would stop. It needs energy dissipation to continue. And it turns out that it takes, there's a very fixed number to this, every $1,000 of fiscal wealth associated with our civilization requires 7 watts of continuous energy consumption to continue. So, I mean, when you're coming back to the expression earlier, you know, why is it that we aren't changing and we're faced with this imminent danger associated with global warming? And it sounds awful, and it probably is going to be awful, yet we are doing nothing to stop it. And perhaps the reason is because, like any other physical system, systems do not respond to their future. Systems respond to their present state as it has evolved from their past. And we are geared to optimize our energy consumption in the present, just like any other system. It could be a blade of grass, a growing cloud droplet, anything else. This is how systems evolve. And, of course, this eventually will come back to get us, because as we are optimizing our energy consumption in the present, we are sending up carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And, you know, that carbon dioxide is going to last for a very, very long time. I mean, there's different timescales involved with this life, length of time in the atmosphere, but some of these timescales are on the order of hundreds of thousands of years. Some are much shorter, but stuff will stick around for a very long time. And if this carbon dioxide is really dangerous, it may knock us off the face of the planet even as it lingers. We could stop consuming energy altogether because the damage will be so great. But the carbon dioxide will still linger. What we have put up there is kind of there to stay. And we can make estimates, actually. We can numerically model this because if we treat things as a physical system, we can sort of make forecasts of where the economy and climate change might be headed. And if you use the approach I do, you get approach results that are actually far more scary than those that are presented, for example, by the IPCC reports that generally talk about the future. As I use traditional economic models that seem to pretend that we can decouple our civilization from carbon dioxide emissions through energy efficiency gains. And that simply isn't true. And they pretend that we can get rich and reduce carbon dioxide concentrations at the same time. But that's a fallacy. We can't get rich and reduce carbon dioxide concentrations because the very act of getting rich grows our civilization. And the larger our civilization is, the more energy it must necessarily consume in order to sustain its accumulated size. And that will necessarily mean ever faster carbon dioxide concentrations, up to the limit that those carbon dioxide concentrations come back to get us.
I don't think the average American has a clue as to the trade-off that they are engaging in with the energy exchange about what they are buying and how that is impacting the environment. In Shanghai today, it was so polluted that all planes were stopped. People were told not to go outside. It was the highest level of pollution that they've recorded, 700 parts per million. That means that you could hold your hand in front of you and you couldn't necessarily see it. The entire city skyline was completely immersed in particulate matter. That's one of the realities. Now, if that happened in the United States because of all the coal burning that they do in China, that might get our attention, where you couldn't drive, you couldn't go into a plane, train, couldn't go to work, and you'd be gasping, and hundreds of thousands of people would die each year because of that. Then we would do something. In the absence of that, I'm not sure that we will. But I really appreciate the insight you just gave us, because we have not heard that before, Tim, so thank you.
Thanks.
Corey, related to what we just discussed with Tim, would you speak briefly about how current efforts by green environmental organizations are failing to recognize the threats outlined? And since you've been a sharp critic of many of these groups who believe adopting a capitalist model for climate change advocacy will lessen the pace of global warming and reduce greenhouse gases, and then second, speak to us about how the Canadian tar sands will be contributing to climate change and the impact that it'll have on people's lives, as we just discovered today that President Obama, behind the scenes, has been encouraging a speeding up of the tar sands pipeline.
Oh, God, that's a lot to cover. I wanted to say thanks for Tim, because I think he's quite courageous for a scientist. There's very, very few that will come out and talk about that. And even though his paper might be very common sense, it's another thing to have a scientific paper that goes that far. And so I think that's great. Basically, the United Nations, all the reports like Tim's, all the papers that actually are dire and try to, you know, make us face what's happening are ignored. And then the happy message, the message, continue, right? Everything's good, keep going. Those are the papers that people seem to embrace. So what does that even say about our culture, the fact that we're more willing to you know, keep embedded in this culture at the very expense of our children's lives? I mean, I think that, you know, speaks volumes. But as far as the green groups, in 1990, the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases came out with a paper, and at that time, they said in that paper that 1 degree was probably pushing the upper limit. Beyond 1 degree, there'd be nonlinear feedbacks. And so we knew way back then that that was the case. 1988, there was a climate meeting in Toronto, and at that time it was discussed that at that time, when atmospheric CO2 was 352 parts per million, we had to cut back 50%. So we've known for a long time, And even when you look back then, you can find Greenpeace papers where they were saying that, you know, 1 degree, we can't go any further than one. That's the limit. You can find Friends of Earth. That's the limit, 1 degree, based on the paper by the UNHEGG. So then jump ahead, 2015 to COP15 in Copenhagen, and you've got this tick, tick, tick group. It's created by the largest advertising agency in the world, Havas, with the world's most powerful corporations and the NGOs. And the limit, they're actually fighting for, quote-unquote fighting, 2 degrees. I mean, this whole 2 degree thing is based on pushing growth. It's not a scientific target. It's a political target. And so you've got the whole, you've got governments, you've got corporations, you've got the corporations running the governments, you've got the NGOs, you've got everybody being fed by foundation money. So you've got this whole monster indoctrinating people, telling people, keep going, 2 degrees, we can keep going, we can keep burning. You've even got Hansen, who's, you know, pretty respected scientist. Everyone knows, most everyone knows James Hansen. He said 1 degree is probably too high, too far. But here we are saying we can keep burning. Oh, we have a budget. We can keep going. We can still keep burning. We can burn. Our budget says we can burn 15 to 25 more years. Well, how? I mean, like Tim said, we've got this methane, or maybe you said it, Gary, we've got this methane coming out. And Natalia Shkova said those methanes up in Siberia could go, those hydrates could go at any time, right? They contain tens, hundreds of thousands of gigatons of methane. You know, if 1% comes out, that'll quadruple. I think, Tim, you might be able to say exactly how much would quadruple the amount of methane on the planet. If you go back and look at younger, driest period, we had a 10 degrees centigrade change in one decade, right? So I think the idea that we keep talking about this as future, you know, and this whole target, it's psyops, you know, keep going, keep going. We don't have to deal with this now. We can deal with this later. We still can keep growing, and it's insane. And, it's such a huge barrier, these green groups that lead us to believe in these fantasies, green economy. The next thing right now is climate wealth. The whole idea is to commodify what the corporations haven't captured already. Every last thing will be commodified. Every tree, ocean, air. And they want to have it done by 2020, right? And it will come under these pleasant names. Ethical capitalism, you know, sustainable capitalism, compassionate capitalism, as if there could be any such thing. As far as the tar sands go, we had this Keystone XL pipeline, one single pipeline out of the whole, a whole planet of huge, huge, huge problems, huge things that have to change. The biggest one being the very economic system itself. But we have this pipeline, and what happens, we have Warren Buffett behind the scenes, who's Obama's financial advisor, funding the number one funder of Tides, the foundation that finances all the NGOs for their campaigns. So we've got Novo, who is Peter Buffett, Warren Buffett's son, and his wife, with this foundation, number one contributor to Tides is Novo, $26 million in the past few years. So while everyone's focused on one single line, pipeline, Warren Buffett builds a rail empire. Rail is booming. It is insane. And the stock markets are going nuts. We've got oil flying all over the tracks. We just had a massive accident in July, where a whole downtown was wiped out by a train carrying oil. Over 40 people died, some of them vaporized in the explosion. Not a word from the NGOs. Don't talk about oil on rail. Keep your eyes on one pipeline. That pipeline comes in, part of the pipeline opens up January 3rd. It's already been built. And they're pretending we're going to stop this little single pipeline. smoke and mirrors. You know, that's the game with everything, smoke and mirrors. You know, you just follow the money.
Thank you, Corey.
Yeah.
Paul, in the past, you've written a letter to the Canadian MPs stating that they should pay attention to foods, how it's grown, and the consequences. I've been extremely concerned as a certified organic farmer and teaching on sustainability for many years. And yet we have little or no conversation about this in the mainstream, even the alternative media, about chemical industrial agriculture and the increase in monocrop agriculture due to GMOs. It's water intensive, destroys soil fertility, contributes to erosion, and a lot worse. Moreover, it's extremely energy consuming and contributes to one of humanity's largest greenhouse gas footprints. So when I couple the kind of industrial agriculture we rely upon today with the future threats of climate change, I believe there's a perfect storm ahead. Now, based upon your knowledge in climate change science, how would you translate that into the threats to our food and land and water resources for sustainable agriculture? And in your answer, please briefly describe to our listeners the relationship between food shortages and the declining sea ice.
Yes, this gets back to the so again the sea ice and the snow cover in the Arctic is kind of the linchpin or keystone of the climate system. The phrase, you may have heard the phrase, "What happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic," and I'd like to lay claim to that statement. I think I did a blog and used that statement, and I've seen it appear many times since. But basically, so as the Arctic warms at much greater rates than the rest of the planet, it disrupts the temperature difference to the equator, it disrupts the global atmospheric circulation patterns, the jet streams, it gives you these wild swings of temperature. It makes some areas lack rain, you know, you get droughts, and then other areas get torrential rainfalls. And sometimes you can swing from one year to the next, from, like, the Mississippi was at record low levels. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was hydraulically jacking rocks on the bottom to make it deeper by a couple feet in some areas so that they could continue barge traffic. And barge, you know, traffic carries, I don't know, 20% of the country's GDP or something like that on the Mississippi. It's a vital transportation link. And then the very next year, there was record flood levels of the Mississippi within 1 year. Here they thought if the drought continues, you know, another month, we're going to have to shut down and reroute traffic. And then the very next year, it's record high levels. So as far as food is concerned, I mean, we've learned from, you know, year in, year out, farmers have learned what their soils, what type of soils they have, how good they are, what crops to plant them, when to harvest them. And all of this, of course, changes with the extreme weather events that are happening. An example of this extreme wave activity was in 2010. Russia was in the crest of the wave and had massive heat waves for 35 days and lost 40% of their grain crop. Meanwhile, Pakistan was in the trough of the wave. It rained just about every day, flooded out about 70% of the country. You know, in the UK, they lost most of their vegetable crop. It was just too wet and too rainy. And then when the rain stopped, it was too hot and too dry. So weather patterns are changing globally, and this is causing a big problem for traditional farming because you don't know when to plant, when to harvest, what crops to choose. Now, and of course, there's tolerance levels of temperature and rainfall for different crops. And as long as you're within those ranges, you're fine. But if you go outside of that range, then a crop that has a very high yield can go to almost to very, very low yield within the space of, I don't know, half a degree change in average temperature or something. Each crop is different, has a different resiliency. So we can't ignore this problem. You know, one of the biggest factors causing large riots and large civil unrest is food shortages. People have to eat. If food shortages are occurring from climate change, lost crops, or other reasons, then people go out on the streets and protest. And in fact, you can tie many, many areas around the world. Look at many areas that have huge civil unrest, and you can relate them to food scarcity causing prices to be much higher than normal in those regions. So this is probably one of the key areas that abrupt climate change causing extreme weather events, how it will impact people, people all over.
Paul, we're out of time. Just one final, real quick, short answer. You seem to be in agreement with Professor Guy McPherson, who we had on this program, about his predictions of the pace of global warming, and he suggested that it could be as high as 6 degrees in 20 years. Do you accept that? And if that's the case, a whole lot of life on this planet would simply no longer exist.
Yes. This is a huge question, of course. It has happened in the past. The climate system is capable of having such a fast response in the past. It's happened many times in the past, mostly from colder temperatures to warmer temperatures. A lot of times in the past, you can relate it to large outbursts of methane. So if such an event was to happen in the next decade or two, then I would say you'd have to have huge amounts of methane coming up from the Arctic. So I think we need to spend lots of money, increase research, and find out exactly what's happening with methane.
Good. Thank you very much, Professor Paul Beckwith, Professor Tim Garrett, and Corey Morningstar for your tremendous input on this program.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all very much for listening.